This is the Wheeler Center podcast.
Yeah, I'd like to start by acknowledging that we're on unceded, illegally occupied Aboriginal land, land of the Kulin peoples. And I'd like you to all join me in paying respects, sing out for all them old people, elders, going right back to the beginning of time and going right forward into the future. All time is one time. Which is a good way to come into the idea of science fiction and, you know, futurism and what Indigenous knowledges can bring to that. So my name's Tyson Yakupoto. I belong to the Uplitch clan from Western Cape York. And here we have Claire Coleman. It needs no introduction. Basically, a yoga from WA who writes about blackfellas in space.
Yeah. Why not, though?
Yeah, why not indeed? Why not indeed? So I'm not allowed to... I've got restrictions. I'm not allowed to do any spoiler alerts.
No spoilers.
I know, which is huge, because if you've ever read one of Claire's books, there's nothing... what we're left with just the grammar, basically, we can talk about. Because... there's so many twists and turns, and she flips your entire world upside down in a moment so many times that there's no detail almost that you can take from the book without ruining the whole thing. Why do you do that?
Because I can.
Yeah, so what's your goal in all of that? Now, you've told me in conversation before about these sort of world-changing things you put out there and almost magic sort of things that you put out there to make things happen in the world.
My thinking is that people do not like to be preached to. But we're in a situation now where the inequality between Indigenous and non-Indigenous people in Australia has continued for 231 years. So I joke sometimes that some people write like it's they're walking up and slapping their reader in the face, and as I say sometimes, I instead like to write so I'm sneaking up behind people and smack them in the back of the head, and then that it kind of beats in the reality of this country, I'm destroying the lie that is this country is built on lies. And I don't like those lies, so I'll do anything I can to destroy them, and that's what I'm trying to do, really.
So what are the grand narratives, mainly, that you're tackling?
Well, colonisation's a damn good start.
The C word,
yeah. if you think about the history of Australia, in Terra Nullius, my first novel, I tackled this notion that the colonial event in Australia was... peaceful, non-violent, and for the good of all. Three things that are utter bullshit. It was it was an aggressive invasion, it was extremely violent, and Aboriginal people have had nothing but suffering from that. And I wanted people to understand that, so I wrote a book using devices to do that understanding. And then...
Which we can't talk about. In case
you can't talk about how I did it, but just it's a brainwashing weapon disguised as a novel.
That's it. Well, I guess, like I said, we can talk about the grammar. That's not going to spoil anything. there is a hermaphrodite character in there, and the pronouns that you use to describe the characters is always they.
Well,
and it's them.
There's a couple of reasons for that. Firstly, hermaphroditic character. In the old lie, I would decide to have a hermaphroditic character. And hermaphrodites are always done very badly.
Yeah.
They're always done as like somehow... they're always written as if they're one gender, no physical sex. So I decided, why not write a hermaphroditic character that is genuinely... impossible to pin down the gender of, has virtually no gendered behaviours. And then I also thought, everyone keeps saying the use of the singular they is difficult. And I think, I mean, it's not very difficult to prove that it's really, really easy to literally just use it. It's not hard. There's one of those things, and I've been saying to people recently, a lot of Aboriginal languages don't have gender pronouns anyway.
Mm.
In Noongar, the Noongar language, yep, there's only one pronoun, that's baal, which means he, she, they, it.
Yeah.
It's actually not that difficult.
Yeah.
So it occurs to me, well, why not just demonstrate how easy it is?
Yeah, well, I mean, at the same time, you know, we'll have something that's not gendered, a pronoun, but then at the same time we have more pronouns than in English because our pronouns are not focused on
gender.
How we're going to classify that person. It's more about your relationships and which, yes, relationship you're in. Is it an exclusive group of people or two people or, yeah, all people or, you know, all these kinds of things.
And a lot more confusing tenses.
Yeah.
Which is, I mean, it's a simple case of what defines a character. People define characters according to very simplistic terms.
Mm.
I thought it would be more interesting. In neither of my novels have I been particularly concerned with describing characters and making their external world visible, the external being visible. I'm more interested in their internal worlds than anything else. So I don't really care what my characters look like.
So you just have fun playing with the English language, though, trying to make it do what you need it to do?
Well, isn't that what the English language is for?
Yeah, well, that's why it's such a unique language, because it's not really coming from anywhere. It's a trade Creole that's kind of just... it's an economic language and it changes shape, whatever people it falls on.
And it's a very strange language because it's built from heaps of languages.
Yeah.
It's always been the language that's fastest to adapt to change. But then there's all these crazy people who say, no, you can't change the language. It's like the language that hasn't been solid or stable or had a stable structure to it ever, so why can't I change it?
Yeah.
Has anyone actually read, anyone in this audience actually read Shakespeare as Shakespeare wrote it? It's really, really, really ridiculous.
Mm.
And yet that was the language at the time. English changes constantly. And there's, people don't realise that there's several kind of linguists accept several unique dialects of English within Australia alone.
Mm.
So why not just let it change?
Why not indeed? Or change it if you feel like it.
Or play with it.
Yeah. Well, speaking of playing and speaking of fun, you do have a character, and it's not much of a spoiler because I won't say any name or anything in particular, but I will say there's a character who pretty much spends half the book flying around the galaxy, hooking up with beautiful women. On an unrelated topic, Freudian analysis of science fiction would sort of say that it's all about wish fulfillment. What do you think about that?
Let me just start by saying my girlfriend's in the front row. the character in question. She's a bit of a naughty girl, but but I'm not. Yeah, whatever. No, that's not a spoiler.
But you're not and never have been a naughty girl.
Well, yeah, I have been. I think many of us have been. I'm 45 years old now, though. I think most writing is wish fulfillment. But for me, it's the wish fulfillment is not on the small lives of the characters, more on the large world-shaking events for the characters. The kind of the wish fulfillment for me is the ability of people to maintain their strength. To me, the important thing about the characters in The Old Lie is how strong they are.
Mm.
And that, for me, I like to think that I wrote... I like to think the strength I wrote of the characters actually comes from me. I'm not sure I can say that with any sort of certainty, but I'd like to think that I'm a strong person.
Well, and you're getting the reader to walk in the shoes of those strong characters as they go through some hard stuff.
Well, yeah, that's
and while they're doing it, they're learning and experiencing an insider point of view on a lot of issues from, you know, refugee crises, you know, to all kinds of
war.
Things. Yeah.
And that's the thing. One thing I like people to understand is being strong is not a balm against bad things happening. Mm. Bad things happen to strong people. Strong people end up having their lives destroyed. Good people do bad things. I would say bad people do good things, but I don't think there's such thing as bad people. Mm. There's just people doing bad things. So really, I just like the idea of writing characters who survive in a crisis, mm. and how they would survive in a crisis and how they would resist and fight. And resistance is an interesting concept because it's not the same as fighting back. I was in an interview recently and I said, the trick to winning when you're facing genocide is surviving. Because if you're facing genocide, or if you're in a war, if you're in a war situation, the person who wins a war, as on an individual level, not on the national level, if a war invasion happened here right now, and all the people in the audience, the people who won in that situation are the ones who actually survive it. That's the only way you can win. To lose is to die. So in that sort of situation, it doesn't matter how... fighting back doesn't matter. Mm. Surviving matters. And I think I was trying to make people think about that as well, the mm-hmm. idea of what is winning when you can't really win.
Mm. So I've been reading a lot of feminist sci-fi because it's just great. There's more to the story. When you, like all the just white male sci-fi, it's quite limited. Mm. You know, you get to the end, he kills the monster, he gets the girl, finished. But there's so much more complexity in feminist sci-fi. What do you think indigenous sci-fi brings to the table?
Waited for a big question.
Yeah.
Well, one thing we do bring to the table, I think, is that I've often say this, that we've already survived things that most people couldn't imagine even facing.
Mm-hmm.
And we can certainly write about that experience, the experience of surviving an unsurvivable cataclysm. It's really weird. People talk about apocalyptic fiction. Every Aboriginal piece of literature is apocalyptic because we are, Aboriginal people are post-apocalyptic people. There has been an attempt to exterminate us. Some of us survived. That was the apocalypse. It's really strange that... But so what we can bring to the table is a way of seeing, which is the possibly the world's greatest survivors. Mm. And also an idea of a future that is not colonial. See, science fiction is very colonial. You think about most science fiction novels, and it doesn't really matter what they or what the story is. In a way, moving to new planets and colonizing them, terraforming them, is always kind of assumed.
Yeah.
And only in feminist science fiction has been a bit of a change lately, with people suggesting that maybe the colonization of other planets isn't necessarily good for the people on those planets. Who'd have thought?
Yeah, that's another thing I like about it. Yeah, it's like, more complexity there.
It's like, who'd have thought that when you invade someone's planet, they might get pissed off?
Yeah. Well, look, I mean, most science fiction is just, that's an underlying assumption and it's a given. The idea that expansionism is a good thing.
Yeah,
and
I know.
Splitting infinitives and too boldly go and all
too
that sort of
too
thing.
Too boldly go when no one
into
has gone
infinity. Expansionism is an assumption.
Yeah, it is an assumption. And that's the one that Star Trek thing that really gets to me because I read somewhere that Kirk was named after Cook.
Oh, get lost.
Yeah, he was. But the weird thing about it is, in Star Trek, they're not allowed to interfere with more primitive races.
Yeah.
If only Cook had been given that instruction.
He was.
He was given instruction not to interfere. He broke it.
Yeah.
He broke the prime directive.
The Queen told him, or the King or whoever, told him they're not allowed to do what they did.
Yeah, no, but they did anyway.
They still did it.
So it's like this idea that expansion is always good, is embedded into science fiction. Without any thought that, I mean, if a planet is livable, you know, the idea in science fiction, if a planet is livable, we can assume that someone lives there, because it'd be I don't see how there could be a planet with an indigenous plant life that humans can come and eat, and then no indigenous species to survive it, and or to try and survive the in the so-called colonization. And certainly, there's often a recurring theme of in science fiction of the poor little native people are being killed by the colonizers. But there's never any idea that maybe the colonizers should have just stuck on their home planet. Mm. We like to think that this has always been this technological solution to environmental devastation and bringing ourselves, which is we'll go find another planet. Firstly, where? Secondly, how are you going to get one out of the gravity well? And thirdly, we'll just fuck that place up too.
Well,
we won't. White people will.
What are your thoughts on how indigenous characters and indigenous peoples are portrayed usually in just mainstream science fiction? Ewoks and Star Wars and all that kind of thing.
Ewoks. I mean, then it's Ewok. I think Ewoks and Star Wars. It comes to an interesting concept because I've been thinking about this and how racist and speciesist science fiction is. I've been thinking about this for a while. If you think about Star Wars, everyone's seen Star Wars. Well, not everyone, but if they haven't, I don't know where they've been. Frankly, I don't know what planet they're living on if they haven't seen Star Wars, but. If you think about Star Wars, there's supposed to be a multi-species federation. You know, there's people from all over the universe all living in harmony. But Star Wars is a what they call a family saga about the chosen family who are going to save the world or destroy it. And all the speaking roles pretty much in Star Wars all human. Among the hero group, you know, the Luke, Leia, Han Solo, etc., there's only one non-human character, and that's Chewbacca, and it's not a speaking role.
No, he's like the dog.
He's the dog. He's actually named after the... The dog was the theory behind him anyway.
Yeah.
George
Lucas was driving around with his dog.
With his dog next to him. He thought that'd be interesting in a movie. And then the Ewoks, they're a native species, again, not a speaking role.
Mm. Oh, they say, like, meet Matt, and wow, and stuff.
So, but... And the other thing is, Star Wars. It is very imperialist, very, very speciesist. And then things occur to me about Star Wars as well. Like right at the start, there's the Jawas there again. They're just squeaky little short people. I don't know what's with Lucas and small people with squeaky voices. But then a guy gets his arm chopped off, right? By Obi-Wan Kenobi. Like I said, if you haven't seen it, too bad. And this is just casually the hero's better than, like, kind of holy warrior, noble dude, chops off some guy's arm, and there's no consequences of this guy's arm being chopped off. I would be more interested in the story of this guy's had his arm chopped off by a Jedi. What's he going to do the rest of his life now? He's had his arm chopped off.
And somebody had already messed up his face, too. He's having a bad
week.
Was
he born that way? I don't know. It's hard to know. But there's this whole kind of... Even if you look at, like, the most noble of sci-fi, it's either a version of kind of the more noble version of colonial travels, like we're going to go and help people, or the noble savage myth is also inside that. But there's also almost always the great white saviour story. And that's kind of what the Jedi were.
Yeah.
They're the great white saviors bringing peace to the galaxy.
Yeah. And the Ewoks, you know, there was a bit of a messiah complex thing going on.
There was. It's like a cargo, like the cargo cult.
Yeah.
I like science fiction, but anyone who likes science fiction has to admit it's really weird. Because not enough people are thinking deeply about what they're writing. They're just writing stuff. Mm. And the stories that the science fiction writers have found interesting for the last 50 years are really white, male and imperialist, which is what I can... To get back to your question, what Aboriginal writers can bring to science fiction is we're not white, male and imperialist. Well, obviously some are male, but we're not white and imperialist, which is important.
Kind of have a bit of a different storytelling orientation.
Yeah, that too.
It doesn't really fit with the marketplace and the culture a bit is a problem. So, you know, we sit around the fire, thousands of years, yarning, like telling stories and then talking about the story. And then we're all these humans, we're all listening to the radio, we're listening to the same show together and then talking about it after. And then we're doing the same thing with the telly for most of my life. Mm-hmm. And then recently, all of a sudden, everybody got their own content. Personally, they're watching on their own, and then they're just like, you know, and then there's no spoiler alerts. You can't talk about anything you're viewing or anything you've heard just in case there's a spoiler. And I think that contributes to, you know, social fragmentation quite horrendously.
It probably does. And at least people who've read the same book tend to talk about what they've read, and we do still get some people sitting around talking. We've got things like this. When we're talking now, I've been doing an average of at least one talking gig a week for the last, I don't know how long, I'm very tired. It's been a while anyway. So there's still this sort of thing. And these people here have had an experience together of listening to us talk, which is a good thing. Mm. But there's still this kind of, most entertainment still is one way. And I'm not sure what I think of that. Though then again, there's also the problem with this sort of idiots you get communicating online, also known as trolls. And I'm not sure they should be having their opinion listened to anyway. So there's that problem as well.
Well, apparently that all of the stuff that happens on social media is like, I don't know, there's thousands or millions of people or whatever signed up, but it's only like 8% of the people who are actually tweeting about stuff.
Sounds about
right. So it's not a fair indicator of social trends anyway. I read that somewhere the other day.
But the problem with that concept is, of course, that that's like that for saying the squeaky wheel gets the grease. There's all these idiots online spouting utter bullshit, and people are listening. But if people don't challenge their bullshit, it becomes almost fact to the people who are listening but not paying attention. So it's like that idea of not talking back to trolls. If you don't talk back to trolls, then the 92% of people who are just listening are only hearing the ridiculous opinions.
Mm. They say don't feed the trolls, but there you go.
You know, I disagree. I think if you if you don't talk back to them, then what they say becomes the only narrative.
Yeah, but then you never wrestle a pig because...
And there's also
you both end up covered in shit, caca, so. And the pig likes it.
Yeah, that's true. There's also don't play chess with a pigeon. Have you heard that one?
Nah.
It's like arguing with an idiot is like playing chess with a pigeon. No matter how good at chess you are, it'll kick over the pieces, shit on the board, fly off until its friends have won. That's Twitter.
It's a Twitter apocalypse. Look, speaking of apocalypse...
Mm.
That's a nice segue.
That is a good segue.
Yeah. But all your work's really apocalyptic.
Yes, it is.
You know, I guess, but from the Wedgler point of view, the apocalypse is always an end point in time, that there's a creation and then everything goes along for a bit and then there's an apocalypse and that's the end of everything. But I guess we know as Aboriginal people that we've survived a lot of apocalypses, not just colonisation, but, you know, there's been meteor strikes and rising sea levels and like three ice ages or something we've been through and, you know, many apocalypses. So we're kind of fine with it. Like, you know, that apocalypses just happen. But then I think, well, that's everybody, you know, because in Europe they went through apocalypses as well. They had the Black Death and all that sort of thing.
Yep.
Why are Wedgela so scared of this particular apocalypse?
Which one?
This one right now where everything's dying. And
that's good. They're scared of it because they can see it coming. That doesn't help. And they brought it on themselves. And also their narrative about apocalypses is that no one survives. That's their narrative, that when the apocalypse happens, everybody dies. I think it's probably 10 years ago now, someone asked David Suzuki if it's really possible for humans to destroy the world. And David Suzuki said no, but it's certainly possible for us to make the world unlivable for ourselves.
Mm.
And that's the thing that people don't realise. An apocalypse is a different thing to what people think it is. An apocalypse is a collapse of the system that exists. It's not death of everybody. It's a complete collapse of your system. that could actually be in... I'm not saying that the climate apocalypse is a good thing, but sometimes the collapse of a system can be a good thing. In a way, the collapse of our economy, which is inevitable, I think, would be apocalyptic, but it'd also probably be a good thing because the economic system is a bit ridiculous. I think white people are scared of the Wajala... Katwara. Bit of Noongar language lesson for you. Katwara means crazy or sick in the head. Katwarojala, sick in the head white people. They're scared of an apocalypse that they created but might not survive. I think they're also scared that maybe they'll get wiped out but we won't be.
Mm. There's, I don't know, I think that's what all the zombie apocalypse movies are about, is this idea that, I mean, they've just got this feeling that all this walking dead poor people from the southern hemisphere are just kind of, they're all just going to just, what's a border?
Yeah. But that's like that, it's like that fear that, that people say that white people don't fear we want equality, they fear we want revenge.
Yeah.
That's the problem. The people in power, what people in power don't realise is the people who without power don't want to climb up the ladder and kick them off. We don't want to go up there and go, well, you know, currently white men or rich white men are in power. Let's have instead black women in power and kick all the white men down into the dirt. I think the rich white men are in power because it's in their nature to want to be in power. I don't think the rest of the world really wants that. I don't think anyone really wants as unequal a system we've got now, except for the people who benefit from it.
Mm.
I certainly wouldn't, if I suddenly sold the rights of one of my books as a movie for $10 million, I wouldn't immediately go and try and kick some rich guy out of his position and say, I'm the rich one now. I don't think that's really how people think unless they're already rich and privileged. I think you have to want privilege to get privilege.
Mm. And it's a limited perspective, though, and really limiting. Like, I'm writing non-fiction because I have trouble writing fiction. I'm working really hard on it.
Most people have trouble writing fiction.
My problem is I can only... All my characters would have to be blokes because I have no idea how to write a woman. I can't do that. I have no idea of the inner experience of a woman.
Then you fit right in the side. You should write science fiction
character.
Then.
I can't do it. Well, that's it. I write science fiction. A planet where there's all just blokes.
No, because everything's
just wrecked.
Look, think of the canon of great science, so-called canon of great science fiction.
Yeah.
Right? War of the Worlds. The narrator and all the main characters are men, except for the woman he's got the hots for.
Mm.
The Lord of the Rings. All male characters. A couple of women kind of swan about every now and then. The Hobbit. Even worse. There's basically no mention of any female characters in The Hobbit. 984, it's all men again. The canon of great science fiction, as they call it, or great speculative fiction, is all men anyway, so I don't think anyone would notice.
But it's just it gives you an advantage, and an oppressed person sees more. See, I mean, you can write male characters because you've been that's all you've seen.
You can write,
like, your media that you've been exposed to your whole life is about male characters, and in order to survive, women have to understand men. So you got that, and there's not much to understand in the first place. So it's easy.
Let me give you a bit of a hint if you want to write novels. You can write female characters without having a point of view character as female. All you have to do is have female characters examined from the point of view of a fucked up man. And then it doesn't really...
I just got to embrace the fucked up.
Well, it's
they could just be hanging around, bikinis or whatever.
And then, so if you write it right, people just go, yeah, that character just as sexist git.
Do you remember that movie? Jack Nicholson was an author and somebody asked him a question, how do you write women so well? And he says, female characters. And he said, I just take a man and then I remove accountability. I think it was called As Good As It Gets or something.
Oh, God. I don't think
that movie was as good as it got at all.
No, I've seen that movie and his character was a total dick.
Yeah, yeah. And, like, you know, it's okay because he was autistic or something.
Yeah, it's weird.
Or OCD or whatever.
It's a weird movie, that one.
It is. God. Helen Hunt's done some weird stuff.
There's a lot of weird movies out there, actually.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like Avatar, that's a weird movie.
Don't get me started on that.
I can't even. I tried. At first, the excessively blue palette freaked me out. That much blue light gives me headaches. I was like, oh God, so blue. And then I started watching it. It's like, wow, how much white savior bullshit do we have to put up with?
Yeah. Yeah, it was the big messiah.
The white messiah.
I was like, I was watching it. Oh, this is Dances with Wolves in space. And you know why we've had to wait so long for a sequel? Because they've had to figure out how to cure Avatar depression first. Have you heard about this thing?
I think I read it in your book.
Yeah, I'm obsessed with it. It's an actual medical condition, Avatar depression. There were millions of people who saw the film and then just didn't want to continue with their lives. Like they just realized how shitty civilization is. I want to be naked and blue on a planet, just living in the bush. Can I just do that, please?
See, Waterworld made me depressed for a very different reason. It's just shit. No, look, that Avatar depression, what that really is so-called civilized white people realizing that civilization isn't all it's cracked up to be. That's all that is.
Yeah.
What they realize is, anthropologists now say that indigenous people from around the world work less hours and had more leisure than people working a job in our civilization now. And in our civilization now, I don't know if anyone else noticed, I'm sure you have, everyone's working longer hours and having less and getting less money for it. So what's happening is we're all, as our society gets more and more advanced, I'll use that term extremely loosely, people are working harder, getting less for it, and being less happy. And yet before white people came, we had enough leisure as with the complex agricultural systems we had here, we had enough leisure to build what's possibly the most complicated cultural and religious structure on Earth while living what white people call a primitive life. That suggests to me that Avatar depression, as you call it, is just white people realizing that they made the wrong decisions for centuries.
Mm. but it comes down on them really fast. But yeah, they had to figure out a whole treatment thing. They had to measure out doses and try and figure out medication for it and all this sort of stuff. I think it's taken about 10 years. We're going to get sequel.
I think they think the an effective medication for that problem would be put them on a desert island naked and see how long they survive.
Sigourney Weaver, though.
What about her?
Just awesome. Sorry, I'm changing the subject.
Yeah, I changed.
But no, the Aliens movies.
I love the Aliens movies.
Like especially 3 with the buzz cut.
Alien 3 sucks.
Oh, get out.
The Aliens movies would be better if they stopped at Aliens. The second one. For a number of reasons, mostly that the third one was fucking ridiculous and that the fourth one was worse. But yeah, the fourth one was way worse.
They should have stopped.
The interesting thing about Alien and Aliens, I've had this conversation with other speculative and science fiction writers, is they changed the way that people look at writing these sort of stories. Before them, the characters people followed were the chosen one hero like Luke Skywalker or the space captain like Captain Kirk. But in Alien and Aliens, the heroes were average people doing an average job. Ripley was a petty officer in the merchant navy, basically, who survived only because she was lucky, mostly. And in Aliens, the heroes were grunts.
Mm.
The officer cops it really early. Another spoiler, too bad.
But what gets
if you haven't seen Aliens, get out.
What gets out?
Get out.
That one soon. But I mean, it's what gets her through that is her nurturing capacity,
yes,
and a really strong motherhood drive to protect,
yes,
like
absolutely,
a little girl,
But she's just an average person, and everyone since Aliens came out, most people who write speculative and science fiction, they write average people.
Mm.
They don't write massively heroic captains or chosen ones, or except in The Matrix, but that movie was again weird. But normally the people are just average, everyday slobs trying to survive become the heroes.
Mm.
And I think it's interesting how that's changed, because I think people are sick of the big guy, the big big hero, great big hero type characters, and they're more interested in the little guy. And that's, I mean, people in Star Wars, people are much, they love C-3PO much more than Luke Skywalker. Well, I do anyway. I think C-3PO is awesome. And he was apparently based on a character from a Kurosawa film where it's...
Metropolis.
Based on a samurai movie. The movie, instead of following the great samurais, followed a couple of servants trying to survive in a battle. And Luke thought, well, that'd be interesting if the characters were mostly focused on, rather than the hero, was a couple of robots just trying to make it through alive. And I think that's how people would rather make fiction now, rather enjoy their fiction now, which is, I think, another thing that Indigenous speculative fiction can bring to the fore, which is we haven't produced any multi-bazillionaires. People don't see us as the heroic chosen ones. Basically, for the most part, we are just average people, and those are the stories we're interested in writing. So. It's like Tony Birch's The White Girl. The characters in that, they're just average people trying to survive.
Yep.
And for Aboriginal people, making it through the day, another day alive, is a red-letter day. It's not like, oh, my God, I didn't save the world today. We're doomed.
Mm.
No, it's like, oh, my God, I made it. The cops haven't killed me today.
Well, look, we write a lot about suffering.
We do.
You know, but does the suffering itself make the writing better? You know, in literary theory, they're always going on about the Russian, the great works of the Russian writers, that it's coming out of, their suffering, and that's what makes it so good.
Well, so far, suffering has certainly made our work popular as Aboriginal writers. Of course, there's that joke of calling it suffering porn, that people want to see how much we suffer and get off on it somehow. And I don't know whether success of books about suffering is because suffering makes people better writers, or it's simply because people like looking at someone suffering and go, thank fuck that isn't me. Schadenfreude, basically.
Mm.
It's a bit concerning that people actually may just be reading suffering for the sake of reading suffering. And that's why I try to steer away from... characters suffering for the sake of suffering.
Right? Yeah.
In my novels so far, I haven't written every character who's suffering. I use their suffering as a teaching moment for the audience.
Mm. Oh, it's pretty much the first half of Terra Nullius.
Yes. Terra Nullius is just a teaching moment anyway.
Yeah, yeah. So...
I don't know how many people out in the audience have read my books, but,
Oh, you got to get them.
Well, thank you.
Yeah. But do you find that the traumatic events in your own life actually sort of give you a richness and depth, to your writing that just wouldn't exist if you just sort of coasted along?
Well, I wouldn't go so far as to say there's been much actual trauma in my life. More, not traumatic
struggle.
Events. Struggle, maybe. More like a kind of unrelenting grind of bullshit. I have not had an easy life. And that, in a way... that long-term struggle and survival probably has enriched my work. I've done things and seen things that really, like, again, another movie reference, Roy Batty from Blade Runner. I've seen things you can never imagine.
Mm.
That's basically how I feel sometimes, that I've lived through things that other people can't imagine living through, and that some people wouldn't have survived through, and yet I've survived these things. And I don't know whether it makes my... it probably does make my writing richer. I don't think surviving these things made me a better person or stronger person, or I don't think it's anything to be proud of. But I think that's why the fiction written by people with more complicated lives is perhaps imaginable as more interesting than fiction written by people who've had nothing but privilege and entitlement all their lives.
Trust fund doesn't make good literature.
Or as the old saying goes, you can't write the blues in the back of a limo.
That's true. But it'll get you there.
But blues will get you to the back of the limo.
Yeah, that's it.
But have you noticed that a lot of really great musicians have gotten really crap as soon as they get happy?
Yeah, yeah. Happiness.
happiness kills.
Happiness
art.
Kills your creativity. You just.
Except
you
I'm actually
it.
Quite happy now, so hopefully it hasn't killed my creativity.
Yeah, me too. This is my happy face here.
I know.
So, now there's a character. Let's get back to this hermaphrodite. It's actually irrelevant to this question, but just to tag that back for everyone else. So he's like this. I picture him as being this, like them as being this space cat. You know?
Yeah, that's not bad.
Now, but they belong to a sort of almost a race or a culture of scholars. Mm. So they're like these academics, these researchers who, like, you know, they pick a particular topic and that's almost like their dharma. That's their life's work. Their life's focus is to explore this topic in depth. To the point that that's what the name that they take. Mm. Like the name that his people take, like each person is named after their area of study.
Yes.
Their focus of inquiry. And so this character's name is speech. Because they're a linguist.
Yes.
What would your name be?
Well, I call them the academy in the novel. I always imagine that it's actually, their name. Not only do they take the name of their field of study or of what drives them, their passion, but that it would change throughout their life if they change their research field. And I had to think about this, like what would be my academy name if I was a member of the academy. I'd probably say my name would have to be Story, because I actually believe in the power of story. To change people, that a good story can that with a really good story, your life can become a case of the time before you read the story and the time after you read the story, and nothing about them is the same. You can become a different person just from reading the right story. You can also become a different person in a bad way from reading the wrong story. I don't think I ever want to be friends with anyone who's read anything but Ayn Rand. So.
Atlas will shrug. Mr. Obama.
But it's like, and I think that story is extremely powerful. So that's my life's work is trying to understand the power of story better so I can use it better. Mm. How about you, Tyson? Let's throw it back at you.
I want to talk about that a bit more first. Because that story is so powerful to me. That's the almost like the spells that hold all of this oppressive system together.
Yes,
are made from stories. They know the power of stories, so they have those big, very grand narratives, particularly of, you know, primitivism and progress and all that kind of thing.
Yep.
It's these big stories that hold the entire structure in place. That sort of power, that whatever that spell is. That keeps this impossible system going. So I kind of see your work as almost like this sneaky little sort of virus or a curse or something. You know, you inject these stories into
well,
that
I,
system.
I've always, since I started writing as a job, really, which started with Terra Nullius, I've often said that. I consider my writing to be like little bombs or little infectious agents to make my thoughts go viral, really. Mm-hmm. Not because my thoughts are special, but because our experience as Aboriginal people is different to everyone else's. And it'd be nice if our understanding of the world goes, because all thoughts are viral. The word meme was invented by Richard Dawkins to explain how a thought can be viral, that it's a snippet of thought can slip from mind to mind via language or via art. So what I was trying to do was make truth go viral by finding a way to infect the world with truth. I don't know if I succeeded or if I ever will, but that's my attempt. So. Stories are like the vector for a genetically engineered truth virus for me.
Well, look, I don't think the dialectic works. You know, this idea that, you know, you can just have the truth there and then you've got lies here and that, you know, you put the truth there on the other end, and somehow it's going to balance out. Because it just, the best you can hope for is a meet in the middle. But I think the ones over here, oh, I got my right hand there. Look at that. They never were going to meet in the middle.
No.
You know, you're always going to end up in the middle of the middle, at least. And then that becomes the new, you know, scope for debate. You can't just... So do you need to exaggerate the truth? Like, do you need to make the truth more and inflate it so that, you know, whatever compromise ends up in people's minds is further along towards the truth than it would have been?
There's that. There's also... There's Michael Moore, the filmmaker, was accused of being a propagandist by the far right. They said he's just a propagandist for socialism. And he said... The far right have had their propagandists for centuries. Mm. Maybe we need some. You know, maybe the people who aren't far right lunatics need our own propaganda to swing the narrative back our own way. Because if we are more worried about truth and freedom of speech than we are about stopping things from getting worse, things are going to get worse. I think we need to. So what I'm trying to do is stop the world from becoming I'd like to make the world a better place. But I'm not sure that we are winning the fight to make the world better at the moment. What we can do with art, with writing, with books, with words, with stories, is stop the world descending further and further into a shithole. And we can do that by basically infecting the world with a better narrative than what we are receiving. It's like these stories about Aboriginal people. For 231 years, most of what's been written about us has been by other people. It's time that we set up so the majority of what's said about us is by us to balance those lies a bit. There are so many, historically, so many lies told about Aboriginal people that I think it's really important that we use whatever methods are necessary to dismantle those lies so that we can start again from the position of truth.
Does anybody have any questions for Story Coleman about how she does that? So there are some mics going around, so stick your hand up. We've got a few minutes left if anybody has a question.
Hi, I really loved Terran Elias. Thank you so much. I'm really looking forward to reading your second novel. I just had a question about who you read, what some of your favourite authors are in speculative fiction and sci-fi.
Sure. There was one in particular that I'll bring up now because it was interesting because I was flicking through the acknowledgements in the back of Tyson's book, this one here, Tyson's book, and he mentioned that he was inspired by the novels of Sherry Tepper.
Oh, yeah.
Best. So was I, frankly. Sherry Tepper is an eco-feminist science fiction writer who does really weird things with stories that you do not know what to expect. I just think of her as...
But there's always a talking dog for some reason. Oh, it's so annoying. Sorry, keep
going. But it's like if you got Atwood and injected it with some weird, you get some Sherry Tepper,
yeah,
basically. And she's someone who's thoroughly underrated. It's like she got typecast as science fiction early in her career, and then at that time, science fiction was considered to be shit poor writing, so she never kind of got the respect of a literary fiction writer, even though she probably deserved it. That's one person I read. I read a lot of nonfiction. And I think everyone who hasn't read War of the Worlds as an adult needs to read it, look at it from a post-colonial perspective because it's very interesting. And anyone, I've read The Lord of the Rings 452,000 times, but I haven't read it in about 6 or 7 years because last time I read it, I realised it's the most racist book in the history of books. And I don't know why I didn't notice that before.
Got to stop these orcs.
Has everyone read The Lord of the Rings? There's a big bit where there's the kingdom of Rohan is being invaded by what they call the wild men. And then when you read it, you think carefully about it, the wild men were the indigenous population who got kicked out when the kingdom was started. So the bad guys were an indigenous population trying to get their land back. Fuck you, Tolkien.
More question? We still got a few minutes.
The obvious. Where does the title come from, and what prompted you to write that story?
Basically, you're doing my job now. No. The title is from a Wilfred Owen war poem called Dulce et Decorum Est. Wilfred Owen died in World War I in the trenches. The phrase Dulce et Decorum Est is part of an old piece of Latin. I've forgotten who it was originally, but it's Dulce et Decorum Est pro patria mori, which means it is a beautiful and glorious thing to die for your country. And Wilfred Owen, in his poem Dulce et Decorum Est, called that phrase the old lie. And so that's what it's about. It's about the fact that glory itself is a lie. But why I wrote it, I was visiting my grandfather's country around the time that I came up with the story for Terra Nullius, and I discovered that my grandfather's grave was unmarked and he was a World War II digger. And then I discovered later on that almost all graves in Western Australia of Aboriginal men who fought in World War II were unmarked. They didn't have soldiers' memorials on them. And then I did more research and discovered that some of those men didn't get... Well, no Aboriginal people in WA, certainly, probably the same in other states, no Aboriginal men got soldiers' pensions. And all the white soldiers did. And then I discovered that none of those Aboriginal men got... war soldiers' estates, soldier settlement scheme land, which was almost always taken from what had previously been Aboriginal reservations. And then I discovered, reading a book called Broken Circles by Anna Habig, that some Aboriginal people, Noongar people particularly, in my ancestral country, kids were taken from their families because the father was not there to look to, like, raise the children. The father was not there because he was fighting in World War II. This happened to Aboriginal people, would never happen to white people. And like often happens when I'm writing, I got angry and I started writing. It's like sometimes the only way I can get rid of anger is to write something that's and write angrily and fast and then go back later and make it less shit.
There was... There's the issue of Aboriginal soldiers who were not allowed to re-enter Australia because they weren't technically citizens, so they had to sort of stay in Egypt or whatever.
And particularly in the Boer War. There's a whole bunch of soldiers that went to fight in the Boer War who weren't given a choice, by the way. They were servants of officers, also known as slaves, who were taken to the Boer War against their will. But when at the end of the Boer War... was during the White Australia policy, the height of the White Australia policy, and no one who was not white was allowed into the country, even if they were Aboriginal. So they were left in South Africa. And some of them, some people have traced families of Aboriginal people who are still in South Africa. And that's fucking nuts, frankly.
You touch on that in your book too.
I do, yeah. I mean, yeah, I have
spoiler.
To. Spoiler. No, that's right. Any more questions? There's much more questions.
Yeah, just earlier in your talk, you talked about how your people survived the apocalypse. And almost in the same sentence, you said something about what we could bring to the table. And I might just stop there. And it's just curious to me that you could have so much harm dictated to you and then say we.
Aboriginal people are really nice people. It's really strange. People wonder how the British managed to... Okay, in my ancestral country, in the south coast of WA, the British arrived and they basically waltzed in and no one stopped them, no one kicked them off the land. And white explorers were only surviving because Noongar people showed them where the water was. The cover is that, firstly, if someone comes visiting from somewhere... You treat them with respect, you show them where to find food and water, you don't let them die. If they die in your country, that's bad luck. Secondly, my people were really, really nice. And we all, I know that I joke about kicking all the white people off the country. I joke about it all the time. But I don't think any Aboriginal person is actually serious about evicting all the white people. Not anymore. I think it's more a case of we're in this together. We're surviving this mess together. What we really want is equality and to be listened to. And it's really complicated, this notion of how we've been treated and our cultural positioning. And the fact that I don't want the environment to be so fucked up that people start dying. Because I like to think I'm a nice person. And all my family are nice. And Tyson's nice. He's a bit of a scary beardy man, but he's nice. And I've never met an Aboriginal person who's not nice. Some people do some fucked up things because they're hurting, but I think everyone's nice. And I'd like to think that, you know, Tyson's book is called How Indigenous Thinking Can Save the World. That's what we're about. I'm trying to save the world. Tyson's trying to save the world. And we can't save the world without your help, frankly. Because you've got all the money and the numbers. You outnumber us, all right?
Well, that was a really good place to end it.
But it's true, though. Good. We're outnumbered.
That's true.
Okay, I'll say another thing. If Indigenous people outnumbered white people in Australia, we would not treat you like you treat us. We would not do that. We would not, have a Northern Territory... Look, if the Northern Territory people outnumbered white people, like, was it 20 to 1 or something, they would not have a Victorian intervention and ban alcohol and lock up anyone and have a 100% white incarceration rate. No one does that, okay? It's just not nice. So it's interesting that Aboriginal people would not treat anybody the way that people have treated us. And that's it. That maybe is the lesson I'm trying to teach people in my writing. Maybe what I'm trying to say is, don't be a dick.
Well, there's a bunch of books up the back available for sale and signing now by Claire Story Coleman and some other fella. So, yeah.
We've got both of us have our books at the back.
If you're lacking those books, then...
This is my new one, this one here. And this is Tyson's, because he hasn't got one on stage. Worth reading. And this is my old one, but it's not that colour anymore. They changed the colour.
That always happens. Nah.
All right. Thank you very much, everyone. Thanks, Tyson.
Thanks, Claire.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.